Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
I don't know what that means.
Sometimes in sports.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with Jane Costin. As usual, we also have a special guest, Osita Nwanevu, staff writer at The New Republic. Dara is feeling a little bit under the weather, so we hope she does not have any deadly coronaviruses
or anything. Even the Vox flu, which is also bad. Everyone has had the Vox flu, and it's been very bad.
That's a COVID 17, I think, is the what's been going around the office here. It's going to be a debate tonight. We don't know what's going to happen, but we know that the South Carolina primary is coming up. South Carolina sort of serves the function of being like the quote-unquote black primary after we open with two super white states, go to Nevada where there's a lot of Latinos. So now is the week for everybody to bust out their takes
right. On
black voters.
It's and like, no, black voters, what are they going to do?
And their pitches. So what are they going to do? They love Joe Biden.
Well, I think that I wanted to widen this out, and that's why I'm so glad Osita is here, because I think that there's an idea.
Do you have a more nuanced take than that?
Oh, I have a significantly more nuanced take than that.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yes. But I think that how the media, and I know we are part of the media, and commenting on the media while being part of the media is the kind of meta that I don't enjoy, but there's a way in which we talk about black voters in politics that seems to rely on tropes. For example, the idea that black voters like Biden because Biden was Barack Obama's vice president, which appears to be, for some people, like the depth and breadth of their analysis, when there's a lot more here, and there's a lot more to how politicians are pitching themselves to specifically black voters, how black voters, you know, are thinking about these candidates, which comes in myriad ways, because that's how humans work. And I think that it's really worth having a conversation about how black voters figure into this primary contest.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Results are far away still, I guess a couple of days away in South Carolina. And yet I think already in this campaign, we've seen people get South Carolina wrong at least twice, just in the polling. And I think a lot of it has to do with the way people think about black voters and their tendencies. I think very early on when people were just starting to jump in, you saw a lot of takes about Kamala Harris, Cory Booker. Because they were African-American politicians, because they were youngish, people thought that there might be a kind of Obama phenomenon going on, that they would have this sort of natural appeal to the black electorate in South Carolina. That didn't happen. Nothing materialized there. And then people moved to saying, like, as you just said, you know, Joe Biden, well-known in the African-American community, obviously, has a lot of credit for being Obama's vice president, but is also just sort of this familiar face. You know, black voters are more, you know, pragmatic, conservative, and they'll naturally sort of gravitate to Biden, and he sort of has South Carolina locked up. Well, now, just in the past couple of days, you know, we've seen Sanders make a lot of gains. We've seen Tom Steyer come out of nowhere with, you know, a helicopter full of money, dumping it in South Carolina as basically a political unknown. And still, you know, he's in third place, I think, right now, and is doing very well with black voters. So I think there's a lot of, you know, absence of nuance. And I think that's important because, you know, in 2016, one of the big stories, not, you know, as central as the white working class story, But another one of the big reasons why Clinton lost that should be considered is there was this sort of drop in African-American turnout in some of the critical states. And if Democrats don't really understand what's going on with the black community, if they sort of continue to take this constituency for granted and say, you know, black people are loyal Democrats and they're rah-rah, you know, I think that, there's a risk of missing what happened there. And so it's important for people in the press, political consultants, strategists, whatever, to sort of take this question more seriously.
I think another thing to note here is that there have been a couple of folks who have made this point, but black voters in general, either black voters have tended to vote for Democrats or not vote. There has not been, as of yet, because Marcus Garvey never got to run for national office, there has not yet been the kind of the African-American populist response that white voters have had in, say, 1968 or in 2016 of shifting from Democrat to Republican on to the Republican Party on populist grounds. What you saw in 2016 was a host of black voters, specifically in Milwaukee and Detroit and elsewhere, who simply said, you know, both of these people seem like they suck and I'm out. Yeah. And so I think that one of the challenges that the Democratic Party faces is activating those voters, because there are, you know, older black voters are very reliable Democrats if they vote.
Yeah.
And I think it's important also to, you know, when we talk sometimes about black voters, we do not give them the same degree of nuance when we think about white voters. White, we somehow can contemplate that what the white voting electorate includes, you know, white working class Americans and people in the service economy and wealthy college professors and, I don't know, people I went to college with. When we think about black voters, the implication seems to be that, like, black people kind of all vaguely similar. When we've seen again and again and again, and we'll talk about kind of the breakouts in the polling specifically on age, that's simply not true.
But so I do want to say one thing about turnout.
Right.
Which is that there was a significant drop in African-American turnout from 2016 from 2012 to 2016. But the drop was down to about the level seen in 2004 and in 2000.
Right.
And there's a nuanced take on, like, black versus white turnout, right, which is that a larger share of white people voted in 2016 than of African Americans, but also across the board, college graduates voted a much higher rate than people who haven't gone to college. If you sort of control for educational attainment, African American turnout is higher, even in 2016, than white turnout, although they're close. And then it's Asian and Latino turnout is really, really, really low. So, you know, a question for Democrats, right? Obama definitely, I mean, in 2008, he won by such a large margin that nothing in particular mattered. But in 2012, he got an extraordinarily high African-American turnout. And had Hillary Clinton been able to replicate that, she would have won.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's like, why did a white person not generate the same level of super unusual enthusiasm that a historic figure, you know, so it's like Democrats have never replicated JFK's performance with white Catholics,
mm-hmm.
and like they're not going to, you know, that's not like a tactical failing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just that like some things you can only do once. Although what's interesting in that regard, you mentioned this, like my very lazy take was like Cory Booker will probably pull well with African Americans,
right.
And he really didn't. And that's been an important impact on the whole campaign, right? Because he wound up dropping out. But had there been a narrative going where it's like, well, New Hampshire looks rough for him,
mm-hmm.
but he's in really good shape in South Carolina, then once this Bernie panic set in, like moderates might have flocked
of course,
to him.
Yeah.
He's just a much more like charismatic public speaker than say Amy Klobuchar is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've read a lot of takes like whatever happened to Cory Booker, but like what happened to Cory Booker is that what people thought might be his base like turned out to not be interested.
Yeah, I think that, and I'll relate this to an experience that I think many queer people have, which is that occasionally, like let's say, you know, when I came out in college, I routinely had people who would introduce me to other queer women that they knew with the implication that like, well, you're queer and she's queer, so, and
right.
then we both look at each other being like, No, thank you. And so I think that there is an idea occasionally, especially outside, you know, for people who are not African-American or part of this group, that, you know, Cory Booker, black voters, it just makes sense. When black voters themselves, the enthusiasm for Cory Booker that they may have had even a couple of years ago, when Booker was attempting to position himself, you know, moving into inner city Newark, like really attempting to wear the mantle of Barack Obama as he interpreted it, that may have been an effective pitch, you know, had he run earlier. But I just think for a lot of people in 2020, it was just kind of, it wasn't there.
Yeah.
And especially if you think about the voters who are often polled tend to be older voters. And older African-American voters, like my father, are among the most pragmatic of human beings.
Right.
And so, you know, Cory Booker does not, for some of that voting cohort, does not inspire the same level of confidence, shall we say.
Yeah, and I think that analysis extends to policy issues themselves. Because one of the narratives early on was that Joe Biden's record on criminal justice, mass incarceration, his sort of clumsiness in talking about race in general was something that was going to really topple him. And that just hasn't happened, you know. I mean, there was a lot of talk about those issues. Certainly they resonate, I think, resonate more with younger people. Not that older people don't care about mass incarceration, criminal justice, but it's just not the sort of potent topic that people thought would really determine where African-American voters are going to go. I just looked at the recent CBS YouGov poll in South Carolina. 56% of black voters say they prioritize economic issues, jobs. About a quarter say they want to prioritize social issues like race and gender. So in that respect, African-American voters are a lot like the rest of the electorate. Like they want a job. They want to see the economy do well, et cetera. It's not that they don't care about the wider spectrum of issues, but people who thought that, you know, a bad record on criminal justice was going to knock out that candidate and put some other candidate forward were just wrong.
And, you know, one thing that, again, just a common similarity, right, is I think everybody understands that if you want to understand white public opinion, you can't go ask, like, 20 writers and intellectuals. Right? That, like, you know, some of my best friends are white writers.
J.D. Vance, maybe. And he knows everything.
Sure. No, but you know what I mean? It's like the pool of, like, white cultural figures is actually very idiosyncratic relative to the white population.
Yeah.
And is, of course, the same in the African-American population, that if you primarily get your information through, like, professional take-havers, you were looking at a group of people who are more ideological, more cosmopolitan, like, just like in any kind of, like, racial context. And that, I think, carries over, and that's part of what you've seen with Joe Biden, right? That, like, working class people across the board are, like, less invested in some of this stuff about, do you use the right words? Do you talk about things in the right way? I mean, we all saw these, like, clips circulate, and it was like, this is going to be the end for him. And, like, it really wasn't.
I also think, though, that goes to, you know, it's not that those issues of race and identity are not important, but I would say that for a host of especially older African-American voters, their experience is, and I think this is absolutely true, is that this is, in terms of what our racial climate looks like right now, it is not great, but it is better than it was.
Yeah.
And I think that
So it's a lowered expectation.
Yeah, the expectations of, for older voters, especially, I just keep thinking, I bring her up a lot, but my late grandmother, I remember distinctly that when Obama won, she was very excited, but she was like, I'm not, you know, in Thanksgiving, I was like, oh, are you looking forward to the inauguration? And she was like, well, if they let him live through that, I will be.
Yeah.
And just like, she spent the entire Obama era until she passed away in 2015, basically waiting for something to happen to him.
Right.
And the degree of practiced and experienced pain and disappointment that I think are the lived experiences of many older African-American voters, I think really plays into that. And where they're, you know, the idea, and I think that this is Corey Rubin wrote a biography of Clarence Thomas where he talks about Clarence Thomas's black nationalism as part of why Clarence Thomas's conservatism has come to the fore as it has. And part of that is almost an acceptance that, like, America is racist and there's nothing we can do about it. And so his nationalism transitioned, you know, kind of to the sense of, like, well, you know, because of that, the progressivism seems almost inane in this context. And so I think in some ways for older black voters, there's a sense of like, well, you know, we've encountered many people saying the same things as a Biden or even a Bloomberg. We've encountered the same kinds of, you know, lip service about criminal justice reform. And then we realize that that is aimed, you know, that is to the benefit of these people, but not to these people. And so I think an element of kind of practice disappointment plays into how voters rank those decisions. You know, kind of like, yes, it would be great if you would not say these things. It would be great if you weren't like this, but we're not going to get that. We're not going to get to experience it. So we'll just go for this because this seems unattainable.
Let's take a break, and then I want to return to this question of criminal justice reform.
Yes.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So to me, it's really striking looking at the 2020 cycle, and to an extent 2016 as well, that it seems like all kinds of candidates, when they like want to say something to an African-American audience, that like this is where they go, right? And it's really questionable to me, like that it doesn't seem to have worked in exactly the right way. Right, or the predicted way. And I feel like we're going to step back from this campaign at some point. I mean, whether it's Biden or Sanders who wins South Carolina or whatever happens, and say, like, why did everybody decide that this was, like, the number one thing to talk about when you're talking about a population that, you know, there's this incredible, like, discourse on, like, economic anxiety versus whatever among working class white people, mm-hmm. but it's like non-white people also have tangible economic interests,
right,
and jobs and healthcare and everything else like that. And the sense I get is that, like, with both Biden and Sanders doing well, that they are offering, like, different versions of a kind of material politics, with Biden offering a sort of a moderate version and Sanders offering a kind of lefty version.
Yeah.
But they're both like these like cranky old guys who center kitchen table issues over other things.
Right.
And that just seems, it seems to me like that's what like all kinds of people want. I mean, that it's telling that those are the two candidates who seem to do well in the polls with African Americans, right? That there's no like middle ground constituency for Pete and Amy Klobuchar, mm-hmm. and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, so one other thing I've been thinking about is that if you really did want to engage with the African American electorate on cultural issues, on social issues, you know, apart from the sort of basic economic message, I was looking at, again, you know, some of the recent polling coming out of South Carolina, CBS YouGov. They asked people what they wanted to see in a president, whether they valued experience, authenticity, all that kind of stuff. Then they turned to the question of faith, whether they think it's important for candidates to talk about their religious faith. 30% of whites said it was important to them to have a candidate before them talking openly about their faith. 79% of black voters said it was important, with 47% saying it was very or extremely. Now, if you had said that in 2004, 2008, uh-huh. people would have said, well, bib-wib, obviously. Like, you have to make these kinds of faith-based appeals, you know, to be competitive in an election. But that's something that's really fallen by the wayside, I think, in our political conversations. You don't have candidates, I think, say for Pete Buttigieg, who's making a very specific kind of faith-based appeal that's not really rooted towards getting African Americans in law. But, you know, we haven't really seen candidates engage in that kind of level with voters in general, not just black voters. And I think that there's a sense in which we've almost forgotten how to run for president in that way.
Uh-huh.
Right? We have these very sort of binary lanes where, you know, these are the candidates who are there to beat Trump, and these are the candidates who are there to do a kind of economic progressivism and try to bring us to a new place where we weren't before, you know, Trump came in, where we weren't during Obama. But there are a lot of different ways to run for president, even within those lanes. And I feel like there just hasn't been a sense of differentiation. Like, I remember, like, in, you know, I was young, but, like, 2004, 2008, you'd have people who'd say, well, that's the faith candidate. That's a working class candidate. That's the economic progressive or mm-hmm. populist. That's, you know, the national security candidate. All of that has sort of been collapsed in different ways into this real bifurcation of the Democratic Party. And again, I feel like that's something that limits your ability to engage in creative ways with different portions of the electorate, including African-American voters.
And especially because I think that when we're thinking about African-American voters, I think we do ourselves a disservice when we don't break down those voters in the same way we break down white voters, where we're not thinking about how black women respond very differently from black men. I'm working on something on how black men and black women view Trump differently, because there's been a lot of efforts by the Trump campaign to reach out to, quote unquote, the black community, a term of phrase I hate unless there are meetings. But, you know, that has been largely a focus on an economic message, which polling has said that, you know, black voters are focused on an economic message. However, that economic message is aimed at black men, not at black women.
That's
The GOP has largely written off black women. I was reading a piece in The Federalist that literally said something like, you know, black African American women don't like Republicans and don't like white Republicans. And that's just kind of the way it is. And with no, like, I wonder why that might be. But I think that when we're thinking about how black women and black men respond to candidates differently, and how those candidates have responded differently. For instance, Elizabeth Warren's campaign is laser focused on black women, who are an extremely reliable voting cohort. Particularly, you know, in 2012, they had the highest propensity to vote of any group. I don't know what the corresponding numbers were for 2016, but they were probably very high. And we've seen that again and again. And almost to the point that something that really annoyed me during the Roy Moore special election was a degree to, like, black women save the day, and they came in here and rescued us from having Roy Moore as a senator. I'm like, well, one, a lot of it was Republicans staying home, but also the idea that African-American women are supposed to be the saviors of democracy in both local elections and on a national level.
But they're reliable voters.
They're very reliable voters. They're reliable voters, but also, you know, white suburban women are reliable voters, and we're not thinking, like, yes, like— save us all. And I think that, but thinking about that breakdown, thinking about the class breakdown, and I think most importantly, thinking about the age breakdown. I've mentioned my 65-year-old father, who basically is like, whomever runs against Trump, I will vote for. Maybe Michael Bloomberg has the money to do it. That is not how people younger than 65 feel. And we've seen in South Carolina and across the board that younger minority voters, younger African-American voters, younger Latino voters, like Bernie Sanders a lot. Older voters, not so much.
Well, and what's fascinating about the age divide, right, is like, you know, identity has always mattered to politics. And we sort of have in our heads a hierarchy of like identity cuts when you analyze the electorate. And traditionally in America, I think like you go to race first, right? That the gap between black and white voting behavior is huge. And then you look at other kinds of things. But it now looks like on the Democratic side, you really do want to go to age first.
Yeah.
That the difference, right, that like young African-Americans, young Latinos, young whites, young white college graduates, and young working class whites, like all really like Bernie Sanders. And that then old people across the board really, really don't. And that that division between, you know, people who have no Cold War context and whose politics are defined by Iraq and Trump and Barack Obama as a kind of baseline, just have a comprehensively different worldview mm-hmm. from people who remember Reagan, are acculturated to the Cold War, and maybe have a different view of what's been going on in the 21st century. And that itself is like a new— you know, it's not new for age to matter in politics, but I think its sort of primary role is quite distinctive from what we're used to thinking about. But you see it everywhere, right? That there's this just incredible age gradient in assessments of Bernie Sanders. And that's not always sort of conveyed through certain like media channels, yeah. which themselves can be dominated by older people.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I sort of, and maybe this ultimately isn't going to matter for this election or, you know, elections in the near future, but I'm always interested in the people who deviate from the norm. Like, I want to hear from and hear about the young people who hate Bernie Sanders and, like, the old people who love Bernie Sanders, because I think that speaks to the ways in which certain messages can break through even though there is a demographic profile that is supposed to make sense and that's supposed to work. And that's very important, particularly for progressives. Like, if you're somebody who really hopes Bernie Sanders wins, you have to ask yourself, like, what is the message or what is the sort of alteration of the message that is going to break through with 65-plus people mm-hmm. who remember the Cold War and the Soviet Union? If you are a moderate, you know, what is the message is going to make through to, you know, 20-somethings, early 30-somethings who really, really care about climate change and are freaked out about it? You know, I mean, there's a sense in which that divide is very real and it's very kind of clean. But I think that, again, this sort of bifurcation of the Democratic Party limits the ways in which we can sort of shape our politics and shape particular messages and have a sort of less predictable, less, you know, kind of flat set of outcomes that we sort of expect.
So, you know, I mean, this is, you know, I like grew up in very left-wing circles. So I know a lot of old people who like Bernie Sanders,
yeah.
you know, atypical people. And, you know, what's interesting is that I would describe them as much more fringy relative
yeah.
to mainstream politics than I would say of young people, right? So, like, I know a lot of young people who like Bernie Sanders who are also just, like, engaged with mainstream politics in a consistent
yeah.
way, whereas the older people I know who like Bernie Sanders are people who spent most of their lives just totally cynical and alienated from politics, like never had a presidential primary that they were seriously invested in, or maybe just Jesse Jackson, you know,
yeah.
who Bernie supported, right?
Right?
But they were people who were like self-consciously, like they didn't expect people who they liked to win elections
right.
ever. And they were kind of a little anti-electoralist in their like worldview about how political change happens. But now Bernie's there and they're like, oh, okay, like this is cool.
Right.
Whereas younger people I know who like Bernie, it's like they have some, you know, some of these young squad house members who they like, or they have a DSA state Senate candidate who they like.
They're
or,
inside the basic construct of politics. Whereas, you know, I also agree, like the older friends of my parents that I see via Facebook who like Bernie are very much of like, it's Bernie is, they think of Bernie as being outside of politics. Bernie is this, you know, here is normal politics. And then here is Bernie Sanders as these two separate entities. And it's interesting because that's not how Bernie Sanders sees himself. You know, Bernie Sanders is like, I've been in the Senate. I know, like, it's fascinating to me.
Because it's like, yeah, like, I know, like, 20-somethings who live in Washington, D.C. Yeah. and work at mainstream D.C. policy institutions and are then frustrated that their 40 or 50-something bosses—
Yeah.
like, hate Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
But, like, their own personal mentality as young people wasn't that they're, like, not – like, they're here in D.C. Like,
yeah.
they're professionals. And that's different from how old people see Bernie. Like, those who like Bernie and those who don't,
yeah.
it's like they're in agreement in assessing Bernie
right.
as, like, really odd.
Right. Which is fascinating.
So bringing this back to Black voters, I mean, one of the wrinkles that I've noticed recently – I haven't really read – enough to fully develop all my thoughts about it, is that, you know, Black people, you know, in polls, you know, tend to seem very economically progressive mm-hmm. across the board. But when you ask them about large government programs like Medicare for All, for instance, you see this kind of division breakthrough where, you know, they'll say that they're all for 15 minimum wage, they're all for students, canceling student loan debt. But, you know, there was this big poll that Yahoo YouGov did about socialism in the primary a little while ago. And there was a 48% plurality of African Americans saying that they supported eliminating private insurance compared to 39% of Democrats. In South Carolina, you see African Americans are less supportive of Medicare for All than white voters. Than white Democrats, yes, exactly. So, you know, Ested Herndon at the New York Times did a piece about this not too long ago where he talked about the level of mistrust or sort of skepticism that some in the African-American community have about large-scale government programs, given that, you know, these are people who have to deal with bureaucracy and they have to deal with a lot of programs that are sort of extant already and understand that the system for them doesn't work in the way that it does for white people or the way that it tends to. And that is something I think progressives should sort of take seriously
right.
and try to understand.
Right, because I think that if your experience of government is the post office or, you know, kind of the base, like government is the things we do together, as Barney Frank once said, that kind of experience where, you know, if your experience of government is, you know, you lost your benefits because of dumb reasons, because you started making too much money, or you were not able to access WIC because of some reason, or in general, because you have faced systemic discrimination with regard to how these programs are administered, especially at the state level, I think that your understanding of what that could look like is, you know, the ceiling is way lower. But I would also say that in general, there's been a lot of, you know, since I write about conservatism, I think about this a lot. There's there's always kind of the, well, African-Americans tend to be more, quote-unquote, conservative on social issues. Why do they not vote for Republicans? Where, one, you cannot make conservative and Republican into one thing. There are many moderate and conservative Democrats, and that is a lane people are trying to get into. But I also think that for many older African-American voters, yes, federal programs have been problematic, but federal programs and, you know, the federal government help to desegregate schools or administer basic civil rights practices. And so I think, you know, the understanding of the full African Americans in this country understand the full breadth of what federal power can look like for good or for ill.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that makes them, again, more pragmatic and cynical about what Medicare for All could look like. I think that makes them, you know, sometimes more cynical about what student loan forgiveness might look like. I also, though, think that that means that they're, you know, the idea of federal involvement or the idea of, you know, quote unquote, big government is way less scary as like a basic concept. It's not, you know, and so I think that the messaging of kind of socialism sucks does not work with people who are like, well, I've encountered bad government systems, but, you know, what's that Muhammad Ali quote about, like, the Viet Cong never called him an N-word.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's an idea of, like, you know, socialism for these groups that is kind of an amorphous concept that does not mean the same things that perhaps it does to other cohorts of voters.
Right.
There's obviously just a certain level of disagreement on this. I mean, this came out really prominently in the 2016 primary, but, like, one take that I think a lot of African-American Hillary Clinton supporters had and that they articulated very clearly and forcefully was that they thought that a politics that centered class and universal programs was going to shortchange African Americans necessarily, and often either explicitly or implicitly, they would cite what's the book When Affirmative Action was White.
Mm-hmm.
Forgetting the author of that book, but I mean, this is an idea that's very present in the literature, right? That, like, New Deal programs were created and implemented in a way that was systematically discriminatory, and then another way of thinking about it that was a minority of, like, pro-Sanders voices at the time. It's more in line with Eric Schickler's book on racial realignment, which is that New Deal programs, they redistributed income to lower-income people. African-Americans, because of discrimination, were much more disproportionately likely to benefit from programs like that. And that's how the African-American electorate got incorporated into the Democratic Party coalition in the first place,
right,
long before Civil Rights Act, things like that. I haven't seen nearly as much sort of explicit discussion of, like, race versus class. In some ways, that's good because that was always, like, an incredibly simplistic framework. But also sometimes it's, like, good to have a simplistic framework so you can pigeonhole where everybody is. And some of that is that, like, Bernie has gotten kind of woker than he was 4 years ago, it seems to me. I mean, I don't know. Is that your perception?
I think so. I think that was one of the critiques that the campaign really took seriously after 2016. So you see more talk about criminal justice and mass incarceration and these kinds of things. I'm just remembering now that there was a whole reparations conversation in this primary for, like, a couple of months that, you know,
it feels like that was thousands
exactly,
of years
ago. But I forgot about it, you know. But that was one of the points this cycle where people really sort of talked about that divide.
That was, like, literally a year ago, right?
Yeah.
I guess so, yeah.
But, and also, to me, I feel like a lot of that conversation was almost less about reparations themselves, especially because a lot of number of the campaigns were like, we should have a study of the impact of reparations. Like, no one even got, like, we were not getting the car out of the driveway on reparations.
Right.
We were sort of sitting and looking at the car and contemplating it.
Yeah.
But it seemed to be, as I think for a lot of these campaigns, a positioning mechanism. And, you know, I like the idea of talking about reparations, the idea of increasing funding to HBCUs, which I think for a host of white Americans, they have very little experience of. Every time a reporter is like, why are these important? They get dragged on the internet. And I'm like, but I think that that really shows in some ways the impact of residential segregation, where the idea of an HBCU seems foreign. Or, like, but I think a lot of these ideas for campaigns has been a positioning mechanism. And I think Sanders in 2016 thought, or his campaign thought, that, you know, if we focus on an economic argument, that means that we don't need, you know, the economic argument is the root of these issues, that from there springs the prejudice and discrimination that limits the, you know, that lowers the ceiling for African Americans across the board. But I think, and I don't think it's so much that Sanders has gotten, quote unquote, woker, like his third eye has not yet opened. But I think that there have been others in the campaign and more conversations to be had about how, and I think that this is something Elizabeth Warren, there's a piece in The Nation that came out yesterday about how Elizabeth Warren is the intersectional candidate.
Oh, yeah. I want to talk
about
that.
Which a lot of people got all up in their feelings about, which I was like, well, one, that was kind of the point of the article. But I do think that there are these contested ideas, and I'll put them in kind of very base terms because people have written books about this. Are prejudice and discrimination the result of economic inequality, and would solving economic inequality reduce or eliminate prejudice and inequality? And I think that that's where you get into the quote-unquote economic anxiety argument about some of Trump's voters in 2016. And I think Sanders, for a long time, basically made the argument that, like, when he talked to the New York Times either late last year or earlier this year, he basically was like, okay, there's, like, a percentage of voters who are just racist. Like, that's just how it is. But
a basket of deplorables, so to speak.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But it was a little basket, like an Easter basket of deplorables. And so then he went on to say that, like, I think that there are a lot of people who voted out of fear.
Yeah.
And voted out of that kind of actual real life economic anxiety. He thinks I can reach these voters and talk to them about these issues that impact all of us. But I think Warren's campaign is of the argument that, like, you know, when we have experienced in this country the least economic inequality, you know, I believe that the number, I looked this up a long time ago, so my numbers could be wrong, but, like, the period of least economic inequality in the United States was, like, 1953, 1954, which, as you might remember, not a really tip-top time in race relations in this country. And so I think that she's taking the argument that the economic development or an economic focus cannot solve these problems. And I think that it's a fascinating way of thinking about this.
Let's take break number two, and then I want to sort of ping pong on that.
Support for The Weeds comes from Hydro. So I hit the gym in the mornings, and let me tell you, it's often a battle not to hit that snooze button again. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. With Hydro, you can squeeze in a fast 20-minute workout. According to them, it'll work 86% of your muscles. Hydro is a state-of-the-art, low-impact home rowing machine that's actually designed by rowers. Sarah Frank is my colleague and works on the business side of things at Vox. She got to try out a Hydro. Here's what she thought.
While the Hydro workouts only took about 20 minutes, after I was done, I really felt like I probably had been working out for at least an hour. I could really feel the burn from my arms to my core, to my legs, and it felt like I was getting a really efficient workout for my time.
This spring, you can join the growing rowing community at Hydro. You can head over to hydro.com and use code WEEDS to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's HYDROW.com, code WEEDS, to save up to $400. Hydro.com, code WEEDS.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
One thing that always comes up when I see politicians talk, you know, sometimes politicians just talk about issues, right? Like, here's what I think about healthcare. But a lot of times reporters sort of like ask politicians to talk about politics. And then you always have to ask yourself, okay, am I looking for a politician who will say something accurate about politics? Or am I looking for a politician who will say something politically smart about mm-hmm. politics? Because, of course, one thing we all know about politics is that the right thing to say and the most accurate thing to say are not always the same thing, right? And every time I hear Bernie talk about the electorate, I think, like, if this guy was writing a political science paper, like, this would be garbage. You know, like, he says all this stuff, like Jane was talking about, that, like, it doesn't make sense. You know, it's not true. But then I think, okay, but if he's a politician, right, it's like, if there are people who are racist enough to vote for Donald Trump, but also not racist enough that they voted for Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And you would like them to vote for you. Like, what is the point in telling them that you think they're racists, right? Like, that doesn't, like, it seems true to me mm-hmm. to be like, this is bad, but, like, there's sometimes a sentiment on Twitter that it's like, we need to, like, call this out, right? And, yeah. like, maybe we, like, the three of us who are in the takes game, like, do. Like, right. we're in the truth-telling game, but, like, are elected officials, is that their job? Or are they trying to win and then wield political power to help people?
I guess that the question depends on, first of all, the extent to which you believe those people are central to your vision of electoral politics and right. how many people you think you ought to win. I mean, Obama had the whole controversy in 2008 where people cling to their guns and religion, blah, 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 blah. He won the election, you know.
Yes.
He won a lot of those people, you know. So there's an extent to which your ability to tell the truth about, you know, racial politics in this country and American history is not necessarily fatal to your electoral chances, you know, given, I think, what we've seen in the past, you know, couple of elections.
I mean, I think that that's the thing is that now at this point, I'm like, is nothing seems fatal to your electoral chances.
Yeah, it's
we have a president who was like, America is a hellhole. And people are like, yes, let's go with that.
Although, you know, like I reread recently Obama's, his like post-Jeremiah Wright speech.
Yeah. Yeah. It was extraordinary.
It was, but I mean, I kind of felt like I was ready to cancel him after some of that stuff.
Right, right, right.
But it was politics.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was great speech writing, but it was like he has this whole thing about his grandmother, right?
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And the point of it was to say that, like, he was not going to be the kind of black politician
yeah,
who
yeah.
was running around trying to police you, white America,
right.
for doing or saying racist stuff. And I think that's a big part of the reason Joe Biden is on the ticket, too.
Yeah,
not despite, but because he had a history of racial gaffes and stuff, right? Like, Obama was trying to signal that, like, he's chill,
right?
Right? In a way that I do think was politically important. If he had suggested, look, the point of my candidacy is that we are now going to have, like, exacting scrutiny of the past racial conduct of every prominent white person in America, that would have gone, I think, poorly for him. Even though the scrutiny, like, would have been deserved on the
right.
merits.
Yeah.
White people do love forgiveness.
They do.
But I think it's interesting, though, because one of the things about politics is that politics occasionally gets, you know, how people win gets removed from the specific context of who they won against and how, you know, what that election looked like. And so I think, yes, the speech after the Jeremiah Wright thing, which now in hindsight just seems kind of like I think people were performatively mad about that. But I think it's interesting also thinking about how this happened in the, you know, towards August, September, October 2008. That was my senior year of college. And I just remember a lot of friends who were excitedly telling me about how they had jobs at Bear Stearns, no longer having jobs at Bear Stearns. But I think the context of how that took place and how this conversation was had and the degree of politicking that Obama did both then and afterwards of, you know, having Rick Warren give a prayer at the inauguration.
Yeah.
Conservative.
Who's Rick Warren? Yeah. For those
yeah. Conservative megachurch pastor who had said some anti-LGBT things. I remember this because I remember getting emails about this from various LGBT groups at the time. But the degree of politicking that he had to do, essentially, to assuage fears and concerns, despite winning really, like, with really large margins, the idea that bringing on Biden and bringing on kind of a host of people that were basically like, I know what you think this election means, but it doesn't mean what you think it means. I know what Rush Limbaugh thinks this election means. I actually went back and looked at what Limbaugh said after the election, like November 6th, 2008. And it was a kind of a lot of like, you know, this is backlash. This is, you know, we are going to get what's coming to us or what they think is coming to us. And you saw that sentiment coming from him after in 2012 as well. But the degree to which Obama felt it was important to assuage those fears and to make it, you know, I hear not so much the post-Jeremiah Wright speech reference, but his 2004 DNC speech
mm-hmm.
About, you know, there is no red America or blue America.
Yeah.
And it's interesting now
that that turned out to be really prescient.
I know.
There's no important geographical or cultural divides in the country.
I know. Well, the thing is, it's like, I don't know, you know, I think if you asked him about that now, he'd be like, I did not believe that. I wanted to believe that, but I also knew it was important to say it. And it's fascinating thinking about that now and thinking about how candidates think about, when we were talking about criminal justice reform and how much that seems to be not just a, I care about criminal justice reform, but that is, and you see it from the Trump campaign most cynically, a, I care about black people and black people care about criminal justice reform, ergo, here we are now. But I do think that the positioning element at play here is really important.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it's also important to say that the electorate has moved left on cultural issues. A lot of that is driven by Democratic movement.
Mm-hmm.
We're at a point now where Republicans say nice things about criminal justice reform. They actually passed a criminal justice reform bill under Trump. Trump goes out of his way to say he's a friend of LGBT people, you know. Well, it's not true, but he makes the gesture. It's a position.
Yeah, I know. No, the idea of it's a position. It's the idea of the gesture. The idea of like, okay, we can that's okay.
Yeah.
That is a fascinating idea of like that you need to say these things or appear to say these things.
Right. Even if you're a Republican, apparently.
So, yeah, I mean, leftward trajectory on social and cultural issues has, I think, been a really, and to some extent, underappreciated feature of the evolution of American politics because it's made Trump's version of culture war politics sort of possible and potent that the center of public opinion moved left enough. The Democratic Party politicians like moved left with it.
Yeah.
And then that opened up a kind of space, right, for things that would not – it wouldn't have like been politically remarkable 10 years ago. Or certainly 15 years ago, to be like, I really like police officers.
Right, exactly.
And also, I think we should stop illegal immigrants from crossing the border. You know, a politician might have said those things, but it would have been incredibly banal, right? Whereas now, these are like politicized concepts. And I think they've been pretty potent and effective politics for Republicans. But that's not because the country is becoming like more authoritarian on law and order concepts is because it's becoming less so, right? And Democrats are raising their aspirations on a lot of these topics, but that's a risky sort of process, right? I mean, you never would have had the kind of embrace of Black Lives Matter, you know, in the past, right? Like when, remember the beer summit?
That's right.
Like early in the Obama years, right? And the like upshot of that was that basically Obama was a apologizing for saying it was bad for a black professor to be arrested for trying to enter his own house, right?
Yeah, it's
this is what made Kamala Harris's run so fascinating to me, because she's a figure that emerges in the national scene like on the cusp of this change, but it sort of Ferguson transition had not happened yet. So she writes this memoir at some point in like the early 2010s, like before Ferguson happens, it's like, I've been a great prosecutor. You know, I've been, you know, not tough on crime, but, you know, I've put a lot of people who needed to be put away. She had all these clips about the extent to which she, you know, did her job as a prosecutor that sounded really good in like 2012 and like 2013. But the post-Ferguson shift happens in such a dramatic fashion. At the time, you know, 2020 comes around, she's having to answer questions about a world that is very different or was very different from the world we now live in on those issues. So I think that, you know, in her candidacy, you can see kind of a transitional figure, somebody who really had to find her footing in this new space after a career spent working to advance herself in Democratic politics under one particular paradigm.
Yeah, and it's that paradigm shifted so quickly.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, though. I mean, the cynical, like, when conservative outlets were like, Kamala's a cop. And I'm like, but you love cops. love cops so much.
Although,
you think they should be allowed to do whatever they want. Why isn't this a good thing?
I mean, I think in retrospect, though, she probably miscalculated in trying to
evolve.
She tried to lean into it a little bit when she came in.
Yeah, I mean, she kind of waffled, right? Mm-hmm. And one issue for her, right, you know, whether you're talking about Bloomberg or Biden, right, those guys are so old and they've done so many different things that they can sort of ask people to, like, don't even think about what I did on, you know, a crime bill in 1994. Think of me as Barack Obama's vice president or whatever. But Harris, like, just hadn't been a senator for very long. Right. She was DA and then Attorney General of California. That was like the vast majority of her career. So it was inherently awkward for her to say, oh, the real issue here is my health plan. Right? Like, her career as a prosecutor, for better or worse, like, that's what she's been doing in public life. And she didn't have a super clear, like, she could have said, like, yeah, I'm a cop. Like, some of this backlash has gone too far. Violent crime is really bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe people would have liked that. At least he would have, the anti-political correctness people would have loved her.
Yeah.
The many, many, those many people who are... I feel like that cohort is a very tough circle to
That's the
score.
Gabbard cohort. That's
oh, yes.
the one she's trying to...
Yes.
To no effect.
Okay, so Tulsi Gabbard, I think, is not going to win South Carolina. But let's make some irresponsible predictions before we close out. Who's going to win, South Carolina?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think Biden is still the favorite, but it's close enough that Sanders could easily.
I agree. I also think I made the comment that sometimes you win by losing and sometimes you lose by winning. And I think
I don't know what that means.
Well, it essentially sometimes in sports, if you know, obviously you want to win. But there are sometimes, say in a college football game, where if the original spread on the game, if you gamble, was like 15 points and you win by one,
sure.
There's kind of the, yes, you won, but also you should have won by more, and that's bad.
You let the gamblers down.
Yes, yes, and they are an angry group, but also the idea of, like, you kind of lost by not winning as much as you should have. Or I think that Biden, who was, you know, Biden was up in South Carolina by 19, 20 points in November. Now, granted, November, thousands of years ago. But I do think that if Biden wins, but only by 1 or 2 points, and Sanders is already essentially, you know, getting himself ready for Super Tuesday, I think that that will be real cause for concern. But I do think that Biden has a good chance of winning in South Carolina.
All right, I'm going to play the odds and say Bernie's going to win, even though he's down in the polls, because then I'll be right and people will remember me. No, but, you know, I think Biden keeps underperforming the idea of Joe Biden in a variety of contexts. And I think we may see that in South Carolina as well. Okay, at any rate, thanks, Osita, for joining us today. It's been really great to have you on. Thanks to Malachi Brodus, our engineer, Jackson Bierfeld, our editor, Jeff Geld, our producer, and The Weeds will be back on Friday.